Caromcast. Welcome to the Caromcast, episode 15. I am here with my co-host, Amy Lynn Chadwick. Welcome back, Amy.
Thank you.
We just got back from Las Vegas, where we were at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, and it was a mind-blowing affair. We spent six days going to seminars, panel discussions, and lectures by really the top people in the entertainment industry, from film and television to radio, web 3.0 advocates.
Video games.
This year they brought in the video game component, which was amazing, because although it was a bit of an add-on, they really did manage to pull in the best of the best. And the game day itself was quite fascinating. They started off with a panel about alternative reality gaming, which I'll get into a little bit later in the program. Then there was a conversation between the general manager of Electronic Arts and the president of a publisher slash developer who's bringing out the new Terminator Salvation video game for Xbox and all the other platforms. And it was moderated by the editor of IGN. Well, he was the editor of IGN. Just the quality of people that were brought out to speak this year was absolutely mind-blowing. Amy and I sat in on a discussion with the president of Disney.
Yeah.
And he unraveled was it 13 or 17 film slate of 3D movies that Disney will be releasing between now and 2011.
I was quite excited because we were the first people to see Beauty and the Beast in 3D, that opening number Belle song. So I was secretly humming along while watching Belle dance about in 3D.
Which was incredible and weird, because I think it's the first 2D cell animation film, even though originally the film actually was considered groundbreaking because it had 3D animation elements working with traditional two-dimensional cell animation elements. To actually put on some glasses and see this thing in 3D is a bit strange, because 2D is not supposed to look 3D, and yet they pulled it off. And I think that they will eventually make stronger determinations about exactly how to treat 2D as 3D. Because, for example, it wasn't like decoupage, where you see a foreground character on one plane and then the background on another plane. It was as though the actual faces themselves had projections into the 3D plane, although they looked two-dimensional, if that makes any sense at all. And what I figured out was that the way they must be doing this is, rather than do, you know, cutouts and lay them so that they feel like planar dimension, they must have used depth maps, which basically involve making certain areas, imagine a black and white image of it, where certain areas are shaded light and certain areas are shaded dark. And so whatever's shaded lighter is closer or further, however they decide to do it, generally. And then the darker elements are either further or closer. I'm assuming that the darker might be the closer. Anyways, because of that shading, imagine that it's not simply things popping out, but that there's sort of a gradiated leveling of the surface. So that was really strange. We also saw a trailer in 3D for, it was actually a teaser trailer for Toy Story 3.
Yes.
And they'll also be releasing Toy Story 1 and 2 in 3D. And I think it was a re-release, but it looked so sharp of Tron.
Tron.
The big electronic-inspired movie that set off so many imitators.
Yeah, that kind of blew my mind.
It really looked like a new Tron to me, although Jeff Bridges looked his age when he originally did it. So I think it's Tron redone in 3D, and I might sound like an idiot once it comes out, but boy, did it look new.
And we saw Up, a trailer for Up.
Yeah, in 3D, which is
more than a
amazing
trailer. It was about maybe 3 minutes of the movie and something for Cars.
There was a separate presentation between the heads of Disney Interactive and the heads of Adobe Systems. Adobe is, of course, the people that brought you Photoshop and Lightroom and After Effects and Premiere Pro. And a couple of years ago, bought Macromedia, so they now control Flash as well and Dreamweaver and all of those design tools. And they made some pretty extraordinary announcements. One of them was software called Adobe Story, which will actually allow you to start in Adobe software at the script level. So as you're writing your story, you have the screenplay software there within Adobe. And then you have the normal scene breakdowns, the index carding, and everything else. But the real reason for them doing this is that they want, one of the buzzwords this year was meta tags. They want metadata involved in every single stage of the production process. So if you're writing the new Hannah Montana movie and she's talking about jet lag, you would add metadata that says jet lag and it's in the room and it's with the mother and she's wearing green. And you follow that metadata all the way through into shooting, editing, post, and delivery. So what happens is you are always able to do filtered searches for any component of the production at any stage in the production process, in the workflow. And let's call it the Fisher-Price output version of what I'm talking about is, imagine a web-based playback window that allows you to play excerpts from the Hannah Montana movie or the entire movie itself in HD, and you can simply type in a word and it will highlight every spot in the film where that word appears. So if you typed in jet lag in your web player, it'll immediately create little slices that are highlighted of every time the word jet lag is spoken, and you can do an immediate jump to that point in the movie. And I can't wait until the mashup artists get their hands on these tools, because that is gonna go bananas. So that was the first thing that Adobe announced, which was pretty big. The second thing that they announced and expect to release by the year's end is still got a code name. It's codenamed Strobe. And what Strobe is a media jukebox. So you can line up videos that you would program in a sequence, like a playlist.
Like Pandora?
It's not really an end user tool so much as it is for people who want to, say, create their own web TV station.
Okay.
BBC's already using something like it. So what you can do is you can place your videos in sequence, like a playlist, and then you can insert where you want ad spots in that timeline. And you can decide whether the ads are going to be the 15-second versions, the 5-second versions, the 30-second versions. You can track how many hits every one of those videos is getting, what time, maybe even what demographic. You can see whether people respond better or worse to the placement of those ads, and so on. And basically, it gives you a whole bunch of critical metrics about your content that you're playing, and how effective your ads are. So this is now going to be something that you can purchase as part of your Adobe suite. And of course, because it is, it'll be integrated into all the other aspects of the workflow.
Wow.
That might seem like a lot of boring corporate stuff, but trust me, once you can take something like, imagine now you have your YouTube playlist. Well, imagine if you could actually see which order of that playlist had been working best for you. And if you wanted to insert ads that people pay you for number of views or whatever, you could figure out where those ads are doing better and worse.
My question is, though, can you figure out, and have they found the tool, when someone stops playing your video, when the drop-off rate is?
Did you hear anybody talk about stuff like that?
I did, and that was the burning question. I haven't found a solution yet.
Oh, so nobody really had the click off measurement as much as they had the click on measurement.
Yeah, and that's a most important thing. They were just going by downloads, but when you go by downloads as well, you don't really know how long the user listens.
Right, there are companies that will measure, they'll poll audiences, and they do this for films all the time when they're doing test screenings, and they'll give people these little dials, and the dials, you turn them left or right depending on how much you like or don't like something, and it's always on. So as you're watching a trailer or a film, you're rolling it towards the like or the hate part, and they're able to look at the entire audience's responses as a graph and see if there are consistencies. So here's the part where the heroine comes in or the guy falls over and hits himself in the face, And they can decide whether the audience thought that was funny or stupid.
And this is like Nielsen research and ComScore and stuff.
Right, right. And you're absolutely right that having that sort of a tool as online media content creators would be absolutely powerful. And there is really nothing right now that I've seen that allows you to figure out when people stopped watching, when the what the drop-off rates are. Now, when you use something like Google Analytics, there's a thing called the bounce rate, which is how many pages beyond your initial page did people surf through before they left your site altogether. That's called the bounce rate. So if you have a bounce rate of 80, 90%, that's bad because it means people show up at your main page and then they just take off. What you ideally want is a low bounce rate of 10, 20% because that means they're coming in, they're checking out another page, they're going through your links, and they're staying at your site, which means there's more time for them to be looking at sponsors and ads and, you know, maybe buy your MP3 or buy your knitted scarf or whatever it is that you have up there. Of course, when you're making podcasts like we are, we'd of course love to know how long are you paying attention before you're over it and you take off and do something else or you switch back to your music or whatever. So yeah, that's a really important thing. And it's funny you brought that up because I actually tweeted right before we left. I was talking in the last episode about how I would post certain kinds of tweets and all of a sudden I'd have, you know, I'd lose seven or eight followers as opposed to gaining a few. And I asked Twitterverse if there was anything that any app that actually measures or reports to you when people stopped following you, because there is nothing right now that tells you when someone stops following you. Mm-hmm. It would be even cooler if they would say what tweet was the point at which they stopped following you.
Right.
Because that would be huge learning. I mean, you could really figure out why your audience is responding or not responding well to your stuff and even just give you a better understanding of who is following you and why.
It's kind of like immediate feedback, criticism, whatnot, allows you to readjust. They do say that you can track when someone drops off if it's a live stream, and that's the only time.
Right, that makes sense. Well, speaking about that feedback, mm-hmm. it was interesting that we heard both Malcolm Gladwell, the author of Blink, Tipping Point, and his new book, Outliers.
That was great.
And you heard somebody else echo this story later in the day, but he was talking about the difference between a doctor who's a family doctor and he's been able to prescribe things to those family members and he has regular checkups with them and so on, mm-hmm. so that when he works with those members of the family, he's getting a feedback cycle. And that feedback cycle actually teaches him a lot about whether his prognosis or his recommended treatment was the right one or not, and thereby improve as a doctor all the time. And in fact, the benefit of this is that he becomes more and more effective at helping you with your ailments.
Right.
In exchange, an ER doctor, someone who's in the admissions of the ER, never really gets that feedback because all they can do is bring you in, write you up, send you upstairs, and they'll probably never see you again.
When he said that, everything came together for me. Because how many times have we been in the ER and that's happened where you feel like they just brush you off and they don't give a good prognosis.
Right. They throw whatever they think the quick fix is at you. Well, it's dangerous because you could literally be working the ER for 25 years and really not have a clue if every time you throw that medicine or that treatment at somebody, it's helping them or whether they die the next day. I mean, so he talked about one doctor who was an ER doctor and would go upstairs an hour after and actually find out whether the person was doing better or worse or how his recommendation had worked out. What was interesting was that this doctor explained that he actually had to work really, really hard to be able to work that into the process at the hospital, that it was not an easy thing to be able to get upstairs and follow up with everybody. The moral of the story is that feedback cycle is so important. And you have to remember, too, that of course, bad feedback is not a bad thing. Bad feedback allows you to make really, really important adjustments and improve whatever it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. If I knew which elements of the podcast were the ones that make people happiest, then I would do more of that. And if I knew which things they hate, then I would do less of that. And the podcast would become stronger and better. And that's true of a website. That's true of a book you're writing. It's true of the way you dress. It's true of the way you treat people. So that was a really important thing. Which leads me to the discussions about Web 2.0 and what Web 3.0 will be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just wrote on one of my blogs about how in the late 1990s, 99, I think, right before the dot-com bubble burst, for those of you who are too young to know this or who are too disinterested at the time to recognize it, the dot-com boom was really when people started realizing that this web thing was going to really blow up, that the numbers were going to be out of sight, that the web would eventually come to replace TV, radio, newspapers, magazines, retail shopping. Anybody with a half-decent domain name at that time was suddenly able to capitalize their company into the millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. And all of a sudden, you had these 22, 25-year-old upstarts with no business plan, with no marketing plan, suddenly capitalizing these companies like they were going to be the next Donald Trump or Rockefeller. And they're driving around in their Ferraris and these gigantic empty mansions until suddenly one day, the market said, wait a minute, there's nothing here. This is all vapor. There isn't even going to be audiences for all of these upstarts. They made a huge adjustment. The dot-com stock market completely crashed. People lost hundreds of millions of dollars, usually the investors, not the actual, the guys who had been broke a year before and suddenly had $100 million. It was like Cry Me a River. And it was funny that somebody at NAB this year mentioned that even Steven Spielberg jumped on that bandwagon. He had pop.com. And when they asked him years later, you know, what his business plan was like, he said, well, we didn't really have one.
Right.
They were so confident about it. So push content was a big buzzword back then. And what push content meant was, imagine instead of a web browser, you have a screen up that looks like a screensaver or a desktop wallpaper, except that it's dynamic and active. And based on input that you had given it, it would tell you what the weather was like in your neighborhood that day, what time it was, the latest headlines from the New York Times and the sports section, whatever, and you could break it down. It sounded pretty cool. Well, it was a really neat idea, and I really liked it. The problem was that you hadn't gone through really understanding the audience yet. The audience
right.
that was using the internet was still kind of this big, amorphous, anonymous blob. So those companies that were pushing the content and were designing the push content platforms really didn't have a way of fine-tuning this stuff. If you were 18 to 24, that was it. You know, you're either a boy or a girl, and you were 18 to 24, and you'd be getting Hannah Montana and Slipknot all at the same time. And so with what they call Web 2.0, which was all of the social networks happening that started with Friendster, MySpace, Facebook, I don't need to go through the whole history of
it. ICQ.
ICQ, all of that stuff. Basically, what they started getting was very user-specific feedback. All of a sudden, 18 to 24-year-olds were not just 18 to 24-year-olds. They were all sorts of people from all sorts of places. They had all sorts of tribes and groups and user groups, and those user groups had micro-niches into themselves, and it went on and on. And they thought, okay, this is the way the society is going to end. Well, actually, not really. All it did was it provided an enormous amount of feedback and direct connection to people on an individual basis. That is what Web 3.0 will be. Web 3.0 will be a combination of micro-targeted data to the user level, individual user level, combined with a kind of push content.
Well, it's also going to give people portability and mobility. And so everything that they want to see and hear and do and talk about and tweet about is going to be in the palm of their hands. They're going to be able to do it themselves.
Right. They won't have to basically sit in front of their laptop or the web anymore. You'll be able to access this pretty much from anywhere.
Which brought the term outer net rather than internet, because they were saying the internet is at home. It's on your desktop computer. Now we're seeing people with smartphones out and about looking up, oh, you need to know about this. They look it right up on their phone.
Right, like the software Shazam that runs and you can record whatever song on the radio and it'll bring up whatever song that is in its database.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that with all sorts of things. I saw a guy talking about new coupons will be beamed to your smartphone or whatever device you have.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll have the UPC code right there so you can walk into Target, have them scan your UPC code and get your immediate discount. What they recommended to the companies is you don't have to tie that coupon to a specific number anymore. So like when you clip a coupon for the grocery store now, it's a 25-cent savings, right? Well, they're saying let that be a floating number so that Target can decide one day that the discount is for $1 and the next week it's for $5, and you can do all sorts of tricks with that where it's not necessarily cheating anybody, but it's to say, hey, come in and see what your surprise discount is or whatever. And that will be available on all sorts of devices, devices we can't even think of yet. I mean, just to give you an example of what a device might be, other than just the obvious like an iPhone, there's the Chumbi. The Chumbi is a little screen that's a touch screen, and it's inside of a beanbag, and it just sits on your desktop and it pushes content at you. You basically tell it what widgets you want on your Chumbi, and you can just flip through them as you go through your day. You don't have a keyboard. You don't have to do much with it. It just kind of sits there and pushes content at you until you decide to interact with it. So you can have games. You could have news headlines. You could have internet radio. You could have it just be a freaking alarm clock if you want. Chumbi is like just one kind of example, but who knows what else that, I mean, it'll probably be your glasses. You know, you'll be able to put on a pair of sunglasses that have got Wi-Fi connectivity and just look at it inside of your eyeballs, superimposed over whatever's going on in the real world beyond those glasses. That's probably within a year or two.
And there's going to be lots of corporate signage where the internet is going to be everywhere.
Right, exactly.
I mean, we already see it now. If in Vegas, you drive down the street and you see walls and walls of videos and,
right,
and news feeds.
The videos are there for everybody, but imagine a time when those billboards are reading your little UPC code or your iPhone ID, your open ID, and the billboard changes just for you. So as you drive by the billboard, it's saying, hey, you from demographic 18 to 24, blonde, blue-eyed girl from wherever, here's a deal you're going to love. And by the time your car's driven by, it's already transitioning to the next person.
Sold. Another cool thing before we wrap that topic up is Adobe is putting Flash on your TV. They announced it last Tuesday, where you can get Hulu right to your living room.
Yeah, that's big.
Mm-hmm.
We also saw them demonstrate the power of that when they showed us a Hannah Montana movie streaming in HD on an iPhone with a Flash interface over top. So because it's Flash, they're able to have that HD stream going on the entire time while you're still tapping through menus to see what you want to watch next.
Right.
And that's all happening on your phone.
I think that was the main difference between last year and this year. Is last year, it felt like a bunch of bigwigs scrambling around, seeing the broadcasting and TV and the radio falling down because they didn't know what was going to happen. Because this internet stuff was just coming up, like, where's the TV going? Where's our broadcasting going? Our sponsors, what are we going to do? And now they're starting to get a grasp of it and finding new and innovative ways to give it to us, how we want it.
Yeah, I found that the keynote speech that was given at the beginning really talked about not being left behind, that you, when there's a time of difficulty like this, you don't try to reach to the past and hold on for dear life. You
right.
actually have to fight and move forward, and not just move forward and try to catch up, but you have to fight forward and innovate whatever it is gonna be. And that's how you land safely. For example, they brought up radio, and I'm thinking, oh God, what are they going to say to poor radio and poor internet radio stations and everything, what comes after? And he said, no, we're not going to go somewhere completely different. We're going to go back to radio, but we're going to re-envision how radio should be handled. So they launched this whole HD initiative for HD radio, and they also launched an initiative that just says, come back to radio. Radio is awesome. Radio is free. Radio is available anywhere you are. They talked to all the cell phone companies about embedding FM chips in every cell phone, which makes so much sense. Mm. The reason I bought the Creative Zen MP3 player instead of the iPod originally was because it had an FM player in it.
Right.
Not only did it have an FM player in it, but it could record those FM streams. So yeah, we have Shazam and all of that now, but it was so cool because whatever country I was visiting, I'd be listening to local radio instantly.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't come down to whether I knew I liked it. I didn't know if I liked it yet. I'd never been exposed to it. So when I traveled through the Caribbean or through South America or through Italy, I would just tune into local radio and I would hear what was going on there. And if I liked whatever, the sound of the announcer's voice or the sound of independent radio in Turin, I could just start recording it and bring that back and reference that and mix that up for myself. That is huge, and I can't believe that that's never really happened yet. So there's an innovation that you're going to be seeing in the next while is FM chips. They've already got, I think, Motorola, Nokia, LG, a whole bunch of them on side. And as he pointed out, we're still talking to Apple about it because, of course, Apple is like this total closed gated community. And they're always so scared, but whatever. So.
But we're all friends.
Yeah, whatever.
That's what I heard a lot. Uh-huh. That I don't know why, but talking about the radio reminded me of what Malcolm Gladwell said about the newspaper. It just brought up that story in my head about how the newspaper is becoming obsolete and they're all closing down. And
yeah, Malcolm Gladwell, I'm actually going to write about paper as the ultimate technology on my Culture Pin blog because the culture of paper is massive. You go back to Gutenberg and all the way through, and I said this before, William Gibson said that the paperback book is the ultimate technology because it's super high resolution. You can take it in the bath with you. You never have to recharge it. It's portable. It's everything. It smells great, you know.
You can write on it.
You can give it away, and it's super cheap technology. Malcolm Gladwell reflected this statement again. He sort of said, what if the inverse happened? What if the internet had come before newspapers? So basically kids had to have these machines that they have to plug into the wall and then they have to sit there with it and their mouse and that's how they have to look at all their news or whatever.
Lug it down to the breakfast table.
Or their cell phone, you know, it can't be in a steamy room. You can't have it in the shower beside you. You have to always be plugging it in or whatever. And he said, what if that was the way things were? And then all of a sudden somebody came out with this thing called the newspaper. He's like, imagine you have this super high-res technology that you can tear things out of, you can scribble all over it, you can turn it into a piñata.
It's completely lightweight. You can fold it up and stick it in your purse.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing, that transition. And, well, right now, again, we're super dazzled by the lights, and they'll figure out things. I mean, there is this technology called OLED coming out, and I've talked about that before. That's organic light emission display. OLEDs are these screens that use, I don't know, 10% of the energy of a flat panel LCD right now. Its blacks are true black. It just literally turns the pixels right off, whereas with an LCD, it's always somewhat backlit. An OLED has got much lower heat output. It puts out much less electromagnetic static and stuff that's bad for your brain, if any of that is even measurable anymore. But the other thing about OLED is that it can be so thin, it can be as thin as a credit card, and it'll eventually become something that can be put into foldable materials. So you'll be able to wear a dress made out of an OLED screen and just check out your internet from your dress.
Wow.
Talk about corporate digital signage. I mean, your dress will be your new MySpace page.
Girls won't be wondering why people are staring at their chests anymore.
Right.
There'll be a reason.
Some things never change. Man, we talked about so much. We're going to have to break this episode up into 14 parts, but let's just touch on a couple more quick ones.
Because it's so delicious.
Well, I promised to talk for a second about alternative reality gaming. What that is I started the game day listening to Jane McGonigal, who's a PhD and runs avantgame.com. She is a master in the realm of alternative reality gaming, or ARGs. And she demonstrated something that I saw at the Banff New Media Conference in Alberta, Canada, about 12 years ago, where they started talking about these games that you could create with the internet that extend beyond the simple digital realm. So, for example, you go to a website, you sign up, and the next thing you know, you're getting a weird text on your phone. And back then, they used the example of you're getting faxes to your office and whatever. And all of these things are like a giant murder mystery where you're solving a mystery, or you got to find a puzzle, or you've got to geolocate some clue. Well, now it's 12 years later, and checking back in with that community, I listened to this panel of people that was just blowing my mind. For example, one of the things she did was her client was the Olympics and McDonald's, I believe, and they wanted to get younger people more interested in the Olympics and revitalize interest in the games and so on. So they actually invented an Olympic game that involved a bunch of people standing around in a maze, blindfolded, and someone has to be the runner. And the only way that they can navigate their way out of the maze is by listening to those people hum and thereby create this tunnel. And the way that they introduced this game was there was this document, this blog on the web that talked about this old Olympic game that had been suddenly rediscovered, had been lost for hundreds and hundreds of years. And then they had other bloggers in other countries start talking about their findings with it and so on. So the user would come in and start to solve this mystery of what exactly is this game and how exactly does it work? And once they'd pieced together the rules, she started seeing people in other countries start practicing this game and forming teams and improving how the game should be played and developing it until they finally had an Olympics game sanctioned event where they had a simulcast from 8 different countries.
Sponsored by McDonald's.
Probably, yes. And all of them performed the event, and I think the Japan team won. They did it in, 5 seconds or something. But it was a beautiful art form, I mean, to look at this thing. And if you take that all the way back to its creation, it was just a person who created an internet game as a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up being a cultural event that was global and was quite beautiful, actually. So alternative reality gaming is when you take the massively multiplayer online role-playing game, the MMO, outside of the internet and you make it a part of the world. You have people who have to solve these weird riddles about cults and this or that. And so they have to paste pieces of paper up on certain places in the city, take a shot of it, send it back to the website. And even the new show Dollhouse has its own ARG component where they have one of the dolls locked in a room and users have to send her videos. And she actually responds to those videos at the end of every day. And then the next day, this sort of creates this cycle of feedback between the character and the audience. And the interface that they built was a video screen that you would just hit one click to record. You just click it and it's already recording you and that would be uploaded.
Mm.
There's another site that Jane McGonigal designed called Top Secret Dance Off. And she found that people really love to dance, that when people dance together, their brains actually show patterns that those two people start synchronizing their brain patterns. And so she wanted to encourage people to dance more. But the thing is, a lot of people hate dancing in public. They're shy, they're embarrassed, they don't know the moves. So she wanted to create a thing where people could dance anonymously, but share that with other people and essentially have this gigantic dancing community. So people put on masks and they put on costumes and they do whatever. And then the game is, okay, you've got to dance in the middle of an intersection. So you go and dance in the middle of an intersection and somebody videotapes it and you post your 5-second dance. Or you've got to do the Watusi in a swimming pool. And so people take up these challenges, and she was surprised to see how many people who say they're never dancers or they've never been dancers are busting some like wicked moves. And you can just Google Top Secret Dance Off and you'll see this like whole social network of people posting videos of themselves. The point being, they're posting videos of themselves in the real world in response to the game. The moderator of that panel, Brian Seth Hurst, actually made a really cool point. He said, if you really want to just start playing alternative reality gaming, the next time you have a waitress come up to you or an airline attendant, don't just treat them like an automaton. Ask them their name. Ask them what they do. You've immediately engaged that person on a completely different level and in effect turned this into the game that it is. Now you're both role players. You live in a common reality. They're not just wallpaper. So I found that really cool, and essentially the point of all of what they're doing is that life is a game, and why shouldn't it be a fun and great game to play, and why shouldn't we play it together? As opposed to our hijinks and strategies to outwit and screw everybody else over, why don't we all participate in it at the same time? And I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
I really did.
It's a good analogy.
I promise you there will be at least one more episode about this because
there's so many things, holographic screens and 3D, and I can't even begin to.
That's right.
My brain.
I have not even started talking about the fact that if this year was the year of the 3D movie, next year, and I mean next year, not 10 years from now, not 3 years from now, next year, 2010, will be a watershed year for 3D TV in your home. You will be watching your high def screens and your old CRT screens with their little DTV adapters. You'll be watching.
It's already available now.
That's pricey, so Raven in 3D.
Even on your phone.
On the show floor, we even saw a video camera shooting us standing there looking at it, and we watched ourselves in 3D in real time, live. That is crazy.
Very crazy.
All right, guys, we have got to turn this off before you turn us off. Yeah, Amy, you're on Twitter at Sings With Love.
Sings With Love.
And I'm on Twitter at Constant Change. That's ConstantChange. Honestly, send me your tweets. I'll be happy to discuss any questions you guys want to tweet me, any feedback you have.
You'll be the tweet king.
I'll be the tweet king, and by the time I am, it won't be Twitter anymore. It'll be some other damn thing. Good having you on the show.
Thanks, bud.
And visit KaramCast.com to check out all our other episodes. You can also subscribe to The KaramCast on iTunes. See you next time.
Wicked. Wicked.